This is Get Lit with Literature, and this is Monk. You can find out more at the website, allbook-books.com, and my Substack page, Musings from Between the Lines. You can subscribe for free, or you can pay a little bit if you want to. So this week, I'm very excited for this interview, which follows this introduction. It's with Todd Miller, the author of Empire of Borders, the Expansion of the U.S. Border Around the World, published by Verso in 2019. It is one of the best books I've read in a while, just the information and the writing style. And so Todd was gracious enough to do the interview after I emailed him. And something I did not get to put into the interview, so I want to mention a bunch of phrases that are used throughout the book. And I'm one who likes to find a phrase to sum things up. So these are a bunch that anybody could pick from. Global border regime. Global tech apartheid. Securocratic. Security industrial complex. Cyber physical wall. Smart wall. Global capitalism's bouncers. These are all reflective of what you're going to hear in this interview about this border system that is just spread around the world, and it's eye-opening and disturbing. So I wanted to call attention to it so people know about this stuff. And if you travel, you may already know about it, but I don't think to the extent that Todd Miller puts into his book. And he has researched and written about border issues for more than two decades, the last 10 as an independent journalist and writer. He's a longtime resident of Tucson, Arizona. Also has lived and worked in Oaxaca, Mexico, and grew up in the Buffalo Niagara Falls region. He's the author of four books, Build Bridges, Not Walls, A Journey to a World Without Borders, City Lights, a good follow-up to Empire of Borders, the Expansion of the U.S. Border Around the World, Border Patrol Nation, Dispatches from the Front Lines of Homeland Security, that's from 2014, City Lights, at Lawrence Ferlinghetti's Press, and Storming the Wall, Climate Change, Migration, and Homeland Security, also City Lights, 2017, which was awarded the 2018 Izzy Award for Excellence in Independent Journalism. And he also has a Substack website page, thebordercronicle.com, along with Melissa Del Bosque. And his website is toddmillerwriter.com. So fasten your seatbelts. It's going to be an interesting ride around the globe and the system of domination as explained by Todd Miller in his book, Empire of Borders. Thanks for listening. All right, welcome, Todd Miller, to Get Lit with Literature. And I'm so happy to have you on, being interviewed. I read your, it's an amazing book, Empire of Borders. It came out a few years ago. What is it, like 2016 or 17?
2019.
19, okay, but it's still ridiculously pertinent. Part of my fascination with the book is I've been sort of loosely studying empire for maybe 20, 25 years. And so anytime I see that in a title, I'm drawn to it. And I'm not even sure where I found your book, but I found it. And it's just, I'll sing some praises before we get into the nitty gritty, because it's a challenging book. It's just, there's so much information in it, and it's just so well written. I read a lot of nonfiction, and sometimes, you know, I learn a lot, but the information kind of drags on. But you mix in like this sort of like a travel log, places you go in Guatemala. I don't know if you went to Africa, Syria, the Middle East, but you know, it's almost like a novel with a lot of information, chocked in there, chock full. Is that kind of by design, or is that just your sort of journalistic style?
I think it's my journalistic style.
Okay.
Yeah, I do a lot of reportage sort of journalism, mm-hmm. which combines a lot of elements from storytelling and analysis and data and all the, you know, kind of weaving it all together.
Yeah, I wanted to read one page and or half a page because it was one of the highlights to me of the book. There's so much. The information is really important, I think, and it's eye opening and it's disturbing because it's such a. It's like the sort of native reservations and ghettos and all these imaginary borders, but they're not anymore. They're like patrolled and guarded as you go into a lot of detail, which I'll let you talk about. But I kind of made a note of some of the, what I would call like the bright lights or things that shine through. So I wanted to read one and then let you comment. This is, I think it's in Guatemala, and you're describing being with this family. Trying to cross a border. Then the van took a swift right. We were going back the other way on a bumpy dirt road. Suddenly, the purple clouds were upon us, moving fast over the landscape. We were going parallel to the main road. We were going to evade the checkpoint. Sandra turned around and gave us a smile. "We don't have papers," she exclaimed, and then let out a laugh that was so joyful that her mother, sitting in front of her with a blanket over her shoulders, burst into laughter too. So did I, and so did Abbott, and so did everybody, and just then the sky exploded with rain falling diagonally over the sky. Off to the side of the road as we drove into the blowing rain stood an old campesino next to his horse. By his look, he didn't ordinarily see Combis drive past his land. I wondered how many similar moments like this were happening around the world. It became apparent, even with the billions and billions spent, the investment, the technologies, the drug-sniffing dogs, the smart walls and checkpoints, how easy it was to subvert a border with a little grassroots organizing, the proper coordination, and a joyful spirit. So that to me is like emblematic of, you know, how to attempt to beat the system.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah, that was a very interesting moment. It was a highlight for me just to be able to sit in the van with those people and that family who I had met them right when they crossed the border.
Mm-hmm.
They came across the border on these rafts. At the Mexico Guatemala border, there's an official port of entry, but below that, a lot of people will just cross back and forth, on just makeshift rafts and that sort of thing. And, as did this family. But one of the things about that family, too, was that they were going to a wake in Tapachula, which is maybe about 30 minutes away from where we were.
Mm-hmm.
And that wake was of a family member. So their family, as in many cases with borders, right, the border had crossed them, had crossed their family, this kind of enforced border. And at that time, when that incident happened, Mexico was really ratcheting up its enforcement of that border. They hadn't been doing it as much before then. There weren't checkpoints, for example, like maybe a year or 6 months before that family could have traveled easily to Tapachula without a checkpoint. But they were ratcheting up at the behest of the United States. The United States was definitely putting on the pressure. And that's what caused that whole incident, right? There was a checkpoint. The van driver had to, The van drivers could have done 100 different things. There was this whole family. They were not connected at all. There was no relationship between the family and these van drivers. They could have just turned around and drove us back to the border and said, "Too bad. We can't get past." But instead, that's what I thought we were doing. I thought we were just going back to the border. They were going to let the family off. And yeah, there was no possibility of them getting to Tapachula. But instead, it takes this quick right onto this dirt road, and I'm like, dang, you know, it's amazing. Like I wrote it, so I don't have to say it too much more about it, but
right.
The idea of a massive buildup of borders that we're seeing not only in the United States, but around the world, just the money and all the effort that nation states are putting into building up their fortifying their borders in different ways, and all the ways that simultaneously happen of people evading, going around creatively, and often in very creative ways, engaging with that border and subverting it. And that too, I feel like I could have written a book. I could write a book just on that alone, like go to different border places around the world and just see how people are trying to get around those borders.
Yeah, I mean, you know, it's that border system, as you know, and like as any, I want to get into later on, maybe talk about the indigenous perspective, because in the last 50 pages or so, you mentioned that a lot, and I have some native indigenous friends, and obviously there were no, you know, the borders are, and they have been for a while, even the way the U.S. states are, it's, you know, it's this man-made obstructions. But now, like, you know, all the technology is just, that's what astounded me about the book, is how much, I was not familiar with that. I mean, I'm aware of technology in the day-to-day world, but I haven't traveled anywhere far in a long time. And so just the amount of money and technology going into that is just astounding. And one of the most telling lines at the beginning of the book, you mentioned the 9/11 Commission report, which this reminds me like of how I got into studying empire, because when I had learned, I think it was Chalmers Johnson who was writing about it, mentioning how many 600 to 1,000 military bases around the world, which is just, you know, astounding. That's been going on for a while. So that's clearly empire. But the line in that commission report, the American homeland is the planet. I mean, that's a disturbing line. Like how much of that is, I mean, is that kind of like their prime directive?
You think? I mean, it could be just a line buried in a 1,000-page minute, right? It could be just that, but it's not.
Yeah.
It's funny, I was just reflecting on that a week ago when, you know, thinking the 9/11 anniversary, of course, and that very line in the commission report, American Homeland, the Planet, and if you watch and see and look at those sort of international border operations that have happened after 9/11, a lot was happening before 9/11, but it really ramped up after 9/11. And the creation of attaches and embassies around the world via Customs and Border Protection. So mind you have Customs and Border Protection, which is an agency designated to protect U.S. borders. But here they are, and I think they have 24 attaches all around the world. So, why is there Customs and Border Protection attaches outside of U.S. borders in other countries? Well, they coordinate U.S. border operations in those countries. This has been really a phenomenon that we've seen happen since 9/11. That line is true. It's very true. And when I was doing the research for the book, even I knew that U.S. international operations were happening as far as the border was concerned. How it works, if you don't mind if I go into this for one second.
Yeah, go for it.
So the United States, particularly post 9/11, in this American homeland is a planet sort of spirit, they send crews to different countries to go to their borders and then look at their borders and then give a diagnosis of whatever border of these country borders. And for example, in 2006, the United States sent a small crew, including CBP agents, to the Dominican Republic, and they did a assessment of the Dominican-Haiti border, in which they concluded it was too porous. And then they also concluded that the Dominican Republic needed to form its own border patrol. And lo and behold, 2007 rolls along, and by presidential decree, Dominican Republic announces, well, we're going to start we have developed this new agency, and we have developed the Border Patrol, which exists to this day. But it was based on this assessment and then the in-country decree. And then after that, the United States comes and does training. Like the U.S. Border Patrol went to the Dominican Republic, trained, you know, their high command and their agents, how to patrol a border. And then they sent equipment as well, a whole list of things. And next thing you know, the Dominican Republic has a border patrol. And that's the sort of model that you can look at in a number of different countries all around the world am a lot in the Western Hemisphere, Latin America, and the Caribbean, of course, like that southern border with Mexico, where with the incident with the family that we just mentioned. However, this border, one would think that this border would be limited. I mean, one would think that the border would be limited to the U.S. border, right? But no, it's spread out throughout Latin America and the Caribbean. But also one might think, well, it must be just limited to the Western Hemisphere. Well, no, it's across the world, right? So in empire borders, I go to the Philippines, I go to Jordan, the Jordan-Syrian border, I go to Israel and Palestine. I went there, Israel, Palestine, to look at the industry more than anything else, actually. And that's it. I went to Kenya. I went to different places where there are U.S. CBP attachés, and just to see what they were doing in all these different countries. Like, who would have imagined that the United States would fund the first border patrol in Kenya? Like, why Kenya? You know, Kenya seems about as far away from Arizona, where I live, as you could possibly be. But there they are, right? Funding, much like I just mentioned in the Dominican Republic, doing assessments, funding a border patrol, and helping build a border wall between Kenya and Somalia. And so this sort of idea, this is where you get into that idea of empire, right? You're like, okay, well, this is another... Like, there's an empire, if empires, I hate this metaphor, but this is what's coming to me. An octopus, there are many tentacles,
yeah.
Right? And
yeah.
One of the tentacles, I hate it because it's degrading to the octopus, but I'm just going to use it because that's what's
yeah, happening. It's not yeah. Uncommon use.
Yeah, but the tentacles are many, right? And one of them is definitely this post 9/11 increasing of international border operations. In which often means going and helping other countries build up their borders.
Yeah, I don't want to. You know, there's no need to get into a whole discussion about, like, you know, the conspiracy theories and this and that. That's not necessary, you know, for this discussion. But reading your book and it, when the mention of all this stuff post 9/11, you give some statistics. It really made me wonder, as if the 9/11 was almost like some pretext for all of this, and, you know, how coordinated, I don't know, but, you know, it's just astounding how much after 9/11 has enhanced. I don't know if you want to touch that one, but, you know, that's
well, I mean, it
made me think about it, put it that way.
I mean, I don't, you know, whatever, you know, 9/11, what happened on 9/11 is a pretext to all of it.
Right.
Like, you go and talk to, like, I talked to CBP about some of their international operations.
What's the acronym? What did you say, CDP?
CBP, Customs and Border Protection.
Okay, yeah.
That's the acronym CBP. I talked to one high official who was a high official. He's retired now, but a high official when 9/11 happened, and he talked about the formation of their first, what they call a targeting center. I think it's called a targeting center, in which they had not a targeting center now. I think there's about 1,000 employees in Virginia, and they sit in this huge warehouse like building, and they look at, you know, everyone that's coming into the United States from abroad.
Mm-hmm.
And that's a targeting center. They didn't have one. They didn't have one pre 9/11, but the way he describes it, it's like, oh, the 9/11 attacks happened. And almost immediately, according to his story, he said, well, we put two agents in cubicles, and they started looking at, you know, all the people coming in to the country. And then his whole point was, it started here, right at 9/11, right in that very moment, which is basically, I would say, every time I think about these international operations, I think, oh, that's the moment. That's like the scene, the moment where it started, right? And his whole point was, look at us now, right? So I talked to him in like 2019 or 2018 or 2017, you know, what, 16 years after. And the whole point was, we have hundreds of people now in these sophisticated technological command and control centers, you know, watching people as they come, from abroad, including U.S. citizens. And we have agents. This is probably creepy to some people, some of your listeners out. Agents who roam airports, you know, throughout Europe or throughout other, you know, around the world. And if you, if there's something about you that, you know, gives them a sort of red flag, they can pull you to the side and question you. And airlines are also working in cahoots with CBP, Customs and Border Protection, and, you know, those sorts of things. So, all that didn't happen before 9/11.
Right.
So the idea of whether, you know, without going into any sort of whatever, you know, conspiracy theories or no, you know, the 9/11, whatever, the 9/11 was a pretext, is a pretext to right. All this happened. Massive, massive. In fact, the whole idea of Homeland Security, that was not a word that would be used at all.
Right.
Before 9/11, like the word Homeland, it was funny because Peggy Noonan, you know, the Republican, former Republican speechwriter.
Heard the name, yeah.
She was a columnist for the Wall Street Journal. Very pro, very pro United States Empire, I would even put it.
Mm-hmm.
But she wrote this column. I wrote about this in one of my first books, actually, very first book, called Border Patrol Nation. And, in her column, she said, Homeland is not a word we use. And she even said, she goes, it has Nazi Germany it resonates with something of, I'm paraphrasing, sorry, but it resonates something of Nazi Germany, right? So
mm-hmm.
she gets that connection, a Republican speechwriter, right?
Mm-hmm.
A columnist of the Wall Street Journal understands that the word homeland has all these connotations to it. And it's funny because it's like it became mind numbing within a year. And I think it just rolled off people's tongues
mm-hmm.
almost in. Oh, it has ever since. Like people said, it said without thinking twice about it. But I just think that's pretty interesting because there's that sort of change and that whole idea of homeland and what that means and how, you know, this kind of, yeah, and how then the new sort of border and including this international externalization, some people call it international part of it, spawns from that. You know, that attack. Maybe they're just waiting for something like that to happen just to justify
mm-hmm.
moving in those directions. I don't know.
Yeah, I mean, the word homeland, it seems to sort of stir up this sort of pride and the need for protection, which, you know, then justifies the whole system, which a question I have is, obviously from your book, it's one of the highlights for me is just how two-tiered, I kept thinking of it as a two-tiered system. You know, those with the money and those with the success, and they can travel easily, smoothly, corporations, they can do business around the world. But basically, you know, the marginalized, people of color, minorities, the poor, it's a whole nother system. So I'm wondering how much the oppression against those people is clear, but some would justify, is there any percentage of how the surveillance works, like that they actually catch, you know, nasty people, so to speak, you know, that they justify all the efforts with? Do they have any kind of, you know, legitimate claim to say, well, this is actually helping?
Well, the justification that is used is we're catching bad people, right? That's been the justification.
Right.
That's the justification. The backing up of what they mean by that is very lacking. To use a term, right? like for example, when 9/11, when 9/11 happened, then Department of Homeland Security was created, and then the ICE and CBP, the two border enforcement and immigration enforcement agencies, were formed out of, it was from a previous iteration. But this new iteration under Department of Homeland Security had the priority mission of stopping terrorists and weapons of mass destruction from crossing the border. In fact, I think if you go to cbp.gov, you'll see see that as their priority mission still. And what that implies, right, is that they are stopping, like, in this case, quote unquote, bad people from crossing the border. But since then, how many so-called terrorists do you think they've caught crossing U.S. physical land borders? Zero. They've not caught one.
Astounding.
But that priority mission all this time for the last, what is it, 22 years now? 23 years? Has justified budgets increasing every year. And, you know, then as we go, like, Donald Trump is a perfect example of it. The kind of heated hyperbolic rhetoric that often comes from Donald Trump's mouth, especially, you know, the most recent example, of course, being Haitians eating pets in Ohio, right? Mm-hmm. And how that he just utters those words, and what happens is, though it's not true, it goes into the media stratosphere, right? Because he says it, he knows it, mm-hmm. and it has to be debated. And this idea, it goes back to this idea of the border, right? And what Donald Trump says he'll do is protect the border, and he's going to stop, in the logic therein, people that are going to come eat your pets from crossing the border, right? So that it's so ingrained in the subconscious. And I know that's so easy, Donald Trump's so easy, but you could go to the other side of the aisle and show how, like, the Democrats will do the same thing, but just not use that hyperbolic of language.
Right.
They will still imply that they're catching, quote unquote, bad people crossing the border, when in reality, people crossing the border are 99.9% workers, right? The percentage of people crossing the border are normally, you know, people just trying to reunite with families, or workers, or people looking for work, or people who are fleeing persecution.
Yeah, it's a lot of it is, it seems astounding, but then too, I remembered, and people can look it up on Wikipedia, I forgot when it started, but it's basically like an American policy. It's called full spectrum dominance. And it, you know, it's been around for a while, and it mentions just basically like controlling land, water, air, biological space, and cyber. And so it's like I remembered that before speaking with you, you know, today, Todd, and it's like, wow, they really took that cyber to the hilt, just trying to dominate everything, which I wanted to mention too. I don't know if you're familiar with, but a native friend of mine, he's Shawnee in Lenape, he's done a lot of research about the doctrine of Christian discovery, which goes back to the 1450s and papal documents. His name's Stephen Newcomb, and he calls it the domination system because some of the language that was in the documents, you know, is still going on today. It even mentions when the, you know, colonial settlers came over here, part of the programming was to invade. This is a quote from one of the papal documents, to invade, search out, capture, vanquish, and subdue all Saracens and pagans whatsoever and other enemies of Christ, and it goes on and on. The possessions, dominions, so it's very much a control of, you know, the land and the goods. So I don't know if you're familiar with that, but it seems like to me this historical continuation of disconnecting from, you know, caring for the land and the environment, so to speak, and instead trying to control people.
I think it's really along that logic what we're seeing. I do write a bit about this on Empire Borders, and I think this might be one of my strong concluding points from the book, is that you think of, like, borders, the way the borders are presented to the U.S. public, for example, is one of, oh, we're protecting sovereignty, or we're protecting you from something. But is that really what they're about when you have these kind of massive border systems? Or are they more about, like, as you were, you know, along the lines of what you were just describing, of a system of control.
Mm-hmm.
And the more you look at borders and what they do and what they accomplish, the more that kind of ladder, or it falls way more in line with the sort of dominance theory, the theory of dominance and of a system of control. And how else, right? Like when you look at the United States or any of the United States, has its borders and then it has its externalization to many other countries. So do the Europeans, right? The Europeans and the European Union relies a lot on externalization as well. Australia is doing it as well. So you have these different powers around the world that are all involved in this, in externalizing their borders and often working in cahoots with each other. And, when you think about, like, for example, if from the U.S. perspective and its tendency, or it's the corporate part of the U.S., of the U.S. system, that the corporations that cross borders without any problems at all, they don't have to have anything. They cross at 30,000 feet, without having to jump over a border wall or walk through a desert. And, they land and they can go into communities and extract whatever wealth they want, right? And that's happening all over the place, many different places. There's this kind of extraction, this extraction of natural wealth that's happening throughout the global south. And then this sort of wealth is then transferred to the global north. And what happens in its wake is that communities just get so marginalized and so left in the dust, so to speak, and just kind of, what's the word I'm thinking of, and looted and that of course you cannot look at migration and why people are migrating, why people are leaving where the places they're from, without looking into this sort of these massive policies of extraction and dominance. And that's where I think when the border thing comes into it. Because for this sort of world to persist, a world that's quite frankly unsustainable for the majority of people in the world, and it's unsustainable in the fact, like a power like the United States can't just keep extracting, or corporations, I should say, can't just keep extracting for personal wealth, you know, the riches of the world, or without there being some sort of consequence. Or, you know, we can look at the climate. We can look at climate change and what's happening and what's projected to happen in those terms, and how it is already affecting people and causing displacement. And in order for this world, this business as usual status quo world, to keep going, to keep on, to persist, there has to be a sort of scaffolding, or it has to be militarized. And of course, war is one way, but this sort of border militarization that we're seeing, and the way that it can control people and in different places, and kind of serve as filters of who can cross and who cannot cross, and who's included and who's excluded, and just keep people at bay, is a way to create a sort of militarized scaffolding around the planet, and keep the status quo coming right along.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, all that you just said is hitting so many nails on the heads. That just, you know, sums up a lot of what I got from your book and what I've studied for years. That's the part that's, you know, very disturbing, because it presents a kind of, you know, a frightening picture of the world. But yet, you know, I really appreciate, respect your compassion and your empathy to care about all this stuff comes through in the writing. It reminded me too of a Lakota friend. In their language, he says that there's no word for exclusion. So, and that's, you know, that's like, it's sort of, the exclusion is what's being promoted on steroids. I know you're pressed for time, so I want to kind of get into one more topic if we can. Along those lines, there's a little scene towards the end of the book where I think it's a Palestinian artist is at he's at a border point. And some guy, like, you know, has a gun, and he's, you know, he's asking him, where are you from? And he says, Earth. So that's, you know, that's to me is the correct answer. And then you also cite the Maasai in Africa. Another quote I liked was that They already know what to do. And somebody said, it's not about counting beans, it's about relationships. So I just found that very, you know, whatever you call it, I hear those kinds of things from indigenous peoples a lot, in that perspective. And it's just a, you know, how to get along with people and not get, you know, totally caught up into the finances and who's got more beans. So, yeah, that to me was like the, you know, really, you opened the book towards the end. There was just so many powerful things, and it just sort of opened up with that kind of whatever you call a positive spin. Is that, I know you have another, your following book is called Build Bridges, Not Walls. Do you take some of that kind of thinking and bring it into that book?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, I do.
Awesome.
Yeah. I think that's the sort of thinking that really resonates with me, at least, as a solution. Like, when people talk about solutions, it's funny, like, you talk to people about solutions, you know, you get some people that are like, what's the solution?
Yeah.
And then you want some prescription. And when I think of the solution, that's what, you know, all those sorts of the counting beans versus developing relationships, that idea of relationship and how that goes into the interconnectedness of people and the people with each other and people in the natural world. And when those sorts of relationships are cultivated, this sort of new ways of thinking happen almost automatically.
Mm-hmm.
New world views that are, you know, cultivated. And in those world views, the idea of this border systems that we have just really, in that sort of world view, the borders as we have them are completely absurd. They're so counter-life. And the fact that they're, and then another thing that's alarming about it, the fact that they keep on getting, there's more and more. Mm-hmm. When you look at the threat, there's more border building, not less. More money being, more private companies making money off of it, right?
Mm-hmm.
That sort of thing. And projected into the 2030s to be a $1 trillion industry globally. And you look at that and go, really? I mean, there's serious things that are completely off kilter in a world like, as we were just describing, it's unsustainable keeping on the kind of path that the world is on right now. And it's so obvious that another sort of way is another sort of path needs to be walked down. And were you gonna say something?
Yeah, well, just you reminded, there's some maybe it's in Africa, I think you mentioned, because it touches on the whole climate, you know, change, and so, I think it maybe is Africa, you can correct me. Somebody maybe farming, and say the weather, you know, there's been a drought, but then down the road or somewhere not far away, they wanted to, you know, move and start growing their crops there, because that would be like the traditional, you know, way that's been done in Africa for thousands of years, but whoops, there's a border there. Do you remember that bit?
Yeah.
That to me is just like, that shows like you're talking about, it's just not sustainable and it's ridiculous, because that's impeding on, you know, just growing food.
Totally.
Yeah.
And I think that point also is made to me by one of the Maasai, people that young man who I interviewed in southern Kenya, in Maasai land, and he was a pastoralist. He was part of, you know, that tradition of Maasai.
Mm-hmm.
of herding cattle, and he talked about their traditions and how if there's a drought in one part of where their land or their then they would just move to another part where there wasn't a drought, and the cattle could graze in that part. But his point was now that everything's surrounded by these border lines, like private property. You can't cross this line. You can't cross that line. And, the whole idea, like what he had, what he was saying is for his livelihood and for climate, you know, this to really survive the climate what the climate implications would be for Southern Kenya, which would be more drought, would be this kind of free movement and the ability to move from place to place and to be able to calculate, oh, it's bad here, so I'll go here. But the kind of bounded territory, like you're stuck here, or you can't go here, or you can't move out of this bounded territory, is so against, like, what we need to be doing to adapt and move and go forward creatively as this climate, as a climate crisis continues to unfold. So I don't know. I found that very interesting because the solutions that we see that seem to be apparent have to do A with what we were talking about before, the kind of relationship building and interconnectedness, and B with mobility and the ability to be able to adjust and adapt and move, if situations become intolerable in places where you are and you have to go to another place. And that involves also back to relationships and cooperation and cooperating mm-hmm. and solidarity and that sort of part of it. And that seems to be where we need to move towards in the 21st century, which makes the sort of border building all the more startling.
Yeah, and you know, it brings up the idea of, you know, listening to the nature, to Mother Earth, because, you know, the birds don't know the borders and the rivers don't know the borders, so that's really like that's the natural flow of life. So hopefully, I pray that we can, you know, people can, you know, wake up to that, because, I appreciate your book a lot, and I hope people will take a look at it, because it's just so much information, and it's really eye-opening, and it's because of the way you described how where the trend is going, it's just very significant. So, again, I thank you for doing that. Anything you want to add, or let people know where they can get your book or find out more? You have a Substack page, too, writing about border issues.
Oh, yeah, sure. The Substack page is theborderchronicle.com. I publish every week, me and my colleague, Melissa Gobleski, we publish two articles a week. We look at primarily the U.S.-Mexico border, but mm-hmm. I also tend towards the international stuff, as well. So please subscribe. And my book, if you go to theborderbookchronicle.com, you actually have all my books are on there as well.
Okay.
So
all right.
You can just kind of go down and see all my books. Empire of Borders is the book that we're talking about. And if you want to go directly to the publisher, Verso.
Okay.
Verso, who published, and you can order it there. And I have three other books. You'll find them on the website.
Okay. Yeah. Actually, when I was deciding, I looked at Build Bridges Not Walls. Sounded like more. Obviously, it's more positive and probably more inspiring and all that good stuff. But which is nice. So that's probably next on my list. But I tend to be one that wants to. I mean, I'm very positive and optimistic, but I like to look at the nitty gritty and see what the heck is going on. So that's why I picked Empire Borders first, which it certainly gives. Gives a lot of info, and like I said, it's just so much in here, so I encourage people to pick up a copy if they're interested to learn more. And thanks so much, Todd, for doing this, and I wish you well with all your good works. Keep on doing it.
Yeah, I really appreciate it. And anytime, if you want to talk again, I'm more than happy to.
Okay, that'd be cool. Yeah, maybe somewhere down the road, because like I said, I typically underline a lot when I read books, and then I highlight pages, and I don't know whether it was a conscious thing, but towards the end of the book, like I say, the last 60-100 pages, I just started asterisking, like that's my super highlights. So there was like 15 things I asterisked in the last bunch of pages. So I don't know how much you planned to put the good, you know, not necessarily good stuff, but just stuff that stood out to me. So that's what I meant. There's just so much to talk about, but so I appreciate even this little bit of conversation. But I think you touched on a lot of the essences, so I hope people learn from that.
Yeah. Anytime.
All right. Thanks so much, Tom. Take care. Be well. Todd. Thanks so much, Todd. Actually, I'm thinking of you mentioned the looting. There's a book. Oh yeah, there's a book Tom Burgess I read a while ago called The Looting Machine, which is actually about Africa.
So
I don't know if you read that, and that was to me, that one's like a follow-up. I had read probably the most powerful book I've ever read was Eduardo Galeano's Veins of Latin America, 5 centuries of the pillage of a continent, because he goes into extreme detail and just in this heart-wrenching and opening way about, you know, the pillaging of Latin America, which, you know, you touched on that theme when you said that a lot of the surveillance and control has to do with, you know, is connected with the extraction. So, anyway. But Todd, thank you, Todd Miller.
yeah, no problem.
Okay. All right, have a good day, Todd.
Yeah, you too.
Thanks.
Take care.
All right.